Marine Radio continues here, and we're privileged to be joined by retired Marine officer, a Mustang, and a best-selling author. Scott Houston joins us, and if you followed him, he's been, he's kind of like Where's Waldo, man. Every time I look up on my Twitter feed, man, here's Scott Houston doing something else in some other part of the country. So first of all, Scott, thanks for doing this, and welcome back to All Marine Radio.
Yeah, it's great to be back. It's great to be at your studio live.
Yeah, this
today.
This is the first time I've ever had somebody in studio.
This is the first time.
First time.
Well, even more honored to...
Yeah, because, I mean, first of all, why would I have a guy in studio? That makes no sense, right? I mean, come on. So the fact that Scott said, hey, I want to come and do it in studio, I was like, whoa, what's going on with this? But, you know, he's legit. So I said, not a problem, man. So,
well, I got vetted first because you did take me to lunch to, like, give me the real sniff test like true Marines do. Like,
exactly.
Is this guy credible?
Yeah. Or am I going to have to make him sit outside my house and do this on a cell phone?
That happened, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, my gear broke.
Exactly.
It's down for maintenance.
You got to sit outside. Because I actually just did the microphone thing, like, hey, this might not be working, which is actually true. First of all, Houston, is that... what nationality is that? It sounds
German origin.
It sounds Asian.
Yeah, it's not.
Hsing. I see. Didn't I see some like sauce or something like that in the supermarket?
Hsing. Sure to be confused. Yeah, Hsing. Yeah, German origin.
German. All right. So we need to find out about you so we can figure out if we should believe anything you say or not. So born and raised where?
Illinois.
What city?
Born in Waukegan, Illinois.
That's America, man.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, far north suburb of Chicago. I spent some time there. Waukegan, home of one of my favorite writers, Ray Bradbury.
Yeah. Science fiction, man. Come on.
Yeah.
Are you one of those geeks?
No, I'm not a sci-fi guy, but I respect, you know, the writing process, obviously. I've been thrust through that chasm, much like the chasm of war.
Sold a few volumes, too.
He has, yeah, pretty famous.
Really, from Waukegan. Yeah. You know what's cool about life? Every city has a claim to fame.
Mm-hmm.
Every city, right? I lived in Grand Forks, North Dakota, home of cream of wheat. What? And so I used to have this shtick that I would do with Marines. Like, you know, somebody come in and like, I'm looking for Major McNamara. Yeah, who are you? Oh, I'm Lance Corporal so-and-so, or I'm Captain so-and-so. Hey, what's up? How can I help you? I need this. Well, hold on. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from Waukegan, Illinois. Really? Say it with a little bit of that inflection, so like I've been there? Really? That's a shithole. And they get this look at this and, what? And they say, sir, it's not a shithole. I'm like, hey, Gunny. You ever been to Waukegan? And he would never have been there, but he knew the shtick, right? Yes, sir. Is it a shithole? It's a straight-up shithole. And then the person would always say, yeah, sir, you're right, it is. And we'd laugh like, never been there, man. But come on, you got to be down with your city. Why'd you give in so easily? And then they just laugh. So,
next door to North.
Why is, what's up with the murder rate in Chicago? What's that about? Is that a drug war? What's going on with that?
I think they just have no control politically. I know a lot of Chicago cops, oddly enough, they're former Marines and friends of mine, and, Chicago Police Marines Association. I was just there coming back from the book tour. I went to, New York, D.C., North Carolina, Chicago. I spent a lot of time in Chicago doing some Chicago radio, but talking to those cops and going out was, signed some books for cops, the 25th district for the guys that are listening to the show, 25th.
What?
Love them. Yep. But I think that, again, much like the Marines, they are, they're really victims of the political system and the system, in general. And they're out there doing God's work every day. They're just like I always say, we weren't fighting politics or policies or strategies in Iraq, back in 06. We were fighting the enemy. That was our mission, to kill or capture anti-Iraqi forces. Same thing with the cops. And the fact that the crime rate is, just out of control there, I think absolutely you have to look at the system. You got to look at that, you know, the mindset of the elected officials there. I mean, it's almost unexplainable. But talking to the guys that are having to do the grunt work that you and I know all too well, you know, they're feeling the frustration. But they say that the mortality rates for officers is not bad. You know, they're able to get out there and still be effective, still interact with the community. Much like we do, you know, you can tie it to how we fight an insurgent war or an asymmetric war where you have to be out amongst the people to be effective. I mean, I don't know, this is another true confession I may not have ever aired, but my degree from Illinois State, which I don't like to brag about because they only let us select 50 or 60,000 in every year, is in criminal justice science. So it gets a lot of use. People ask me, hey, have you always been a writer? Like, did you study in college? I'm like, no, I have a criminal justice degree. But through studying that, you know, when the policing organizations were locked away in their cars or in squad houses, they weren't interacting with the people, they saw crime go up. So they started community policing, much like the U.S. military said how to fight an insurgency was to, you know, get out and really live amongst the people, which is how we fought the enemy day in and day out in Ramadi in 2006 and 2007. But being from that, you know, that Illinois being my home state and having just been in that city, it's a interesting parallel between how we fought then and kind of what people see on a smaller scale, even in large urban cities. So.
Cubs or White Sox?
Cubs. I'm not a real sports fan, though, so if you quiz me on any sports, I'll look like a total rookie.
Okay. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's where we're going.
The sports. Yeah.
All right. So how does the Marine Corps get on your radar growing up in Waukegan?
Well, I was that kid that strayed from the pack, didn't do real well in high school. And this is not a true confession. I think I've blurted this out before, but I barely squeaked through high school with a smoking hot 1.24 GPA. And
that's impossible. That's like
that was very possible.
You didn't get through high school. You failed. They just excreted you into the public realm.
They maybe they were merciful.
1.24, is that like an F plus? What is that?
It's I think on the spectrum of D minus minus. But yeah, not a lot of supervision. I cut a lot of class. Probably hung out with the wrong crowd. You know, my first car was a motorcycle. So I didn't have a lot of supervision, and I led a pretty high risk lifestyle. Just even as a young teenager. And then my friends introduced me to the Marine Corps, and you know how they are. They come across with this bravado, and the office was just like your studio, placarded with posters and cami netting, and they sold the Marine Corps to me, and I thought of them as this great big group of big group of risk takers. So I'm like, these guys are a perfect fit. And they sucked me in, and I think it was on my 18th birthday I got sworn in, and a couple months later, shipped off to NCRD San Diego.
And what do you become?
United States Marine.
What am I? Yeah.
I was in the I was a Hawk missile stinger gunner. And
hoorah.
If
it flies, it dies.
Yeah, that was the motto. Yeah. And shortly thereafter, we deployed to Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. And that was a short war.
It was a perfect war.
Some say that, depending on your, perspective. Yeah.
It was tidy. It was clean.
I think
cleaner than your average war.
Well, at my level as a Lance Corporal fighting in Desert Storm, which we not a lot of us really saw any fighting to begin with because it was over so quickly. But in comparison to future combat deployments. I mean, I even write about it in the book. It almost became this forgettable experience for me because it was so quick. It was so clean, and in comparison to the other deployments I'd seen, and much like you, you understand how very bad it can become when a war boils over and it's spilling, into the burner, and you just can't shut the gas off. And that's how it was in cities like Ramadi and Fallujah and Baghdad at certain points during this long war, is it was just so messy. And the things that we saw and did, when I look back in comparison to Desert Shield, in Desert Storm, it was pale in comparison.
Yeah. Give me a lesson learned. That I'm certainly it's an experience. I mean, so you went to war for the country. I mean, I was teaching at IOC at the time. I didn't get to go. Give me a lesson learned as a Lance Corporal from your time, Desert Shield, Desert Storm.
Well, I think it's a valuable lesson of indoctrination that all Marines, all soldiers, all professional warriors, everybody wants a war. I mean, we're kind of talking about this earlier. You know, those that miss it sometimes find other ways to get it. I won't talk about those people that miss their war, so to speak. But I think the lesson I learned from it was how dynamic situations change and how your expectations of what you're going into really are changed, and also at the same time, almost simultaneously validated of what the reality becomes. Because as we sit here in your studio and you look around at all these, you know, for those of you who are here, I'll paint you a picture, you know, because you're in the dark room. Mike's got a bunch of Marine Corps, hoorah, you know, World War II memorabilia, recruiting posters, the best of the best. It's all good stuff. But that's what people look at to join the Marine Corps, because if they were shown a Marine on a working party or sitting on an ammo can at a checkpoint at 29 Palms on range control, nobody would join the Marine Corps. So when you experience...
Well, they might, but we wouldn't want them, right?
We wouldn't want them. No, you don't want a platoon of those guys. I mean, sometimes you do wind up with a platoon of road guards, and that's... Is that the type of officer you are? Because you're the CEO of Road Guard Company.
That's a bad unit to be with. But,
man.
So I'm with you. Yeah. The propaganda.
We
love it. Nobody does it better than us. We love ourselves.
We do. But I think when the reality hits you of what, you know, what war really is, and for those that go in disillusioned, that see the recruiting posters, that see the sexy $1 million Marine Corps and Army TV commercials, they soon realize that it is not this glitzy, romantic fairy tale. It's very different, and it's extremely life-changing for most. I think that you would agree to that 100%.
Bait and switch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you sleep in the rain, right? You're eating garbage, and you can't defecate because the food's not digestible, and you're like, oh, we all do it. Oh, Mr. Tough Guy.
Yeah.
Had to want to do this, didn't you? Well, look where your ass is now. Congratulations.
There's a lot of civilians that will come up, and you've experienced this. It's the thank you for your service, and they say, oh, I can't imagine what you guys went through. And I often think that doesn't even, like, encompass the fighting and the killing and the call for fires. And I sometimes think, I wish you could just have put on all the gear that I had to wear and go into a blue port-a-john and have to take care of business. That in and of itself, you're right, is a significant emotional event. And
when the shit sucker truck hasn't worked for 2 weeks, right? So you have the pyramid of...
Were you the CEO of that company, too?
No. Let me tell you, I mean, you talk about morale killers.
That is a morale killer.
When it's 120 and the shit sucker truck has been broken for a while... And you've got to deal with the mountain, and so you've got to do what women do, which I never heard this term, hovering, right? Till you're in this kind of situation, and you walk in, you're like, and you got these, like, how big are the flies? Like, maybe they're an inch and a half.
It depends on where you're at. 29 bomb flies, or are we talking, you know,
No, we're talking, like, Fallujah flies.
Yeah, Middle Eastern flies.
Like, yeah, they're like, they have a tail hook. They're so big. They have, like, a resting gear. Right? And especially if they've been nursed by a porta shitter that hasn't been sucked out for 2 weeks. Yeah.
It is a surreal experience. That's one, you know, I often say the Marine Corps, despite what level you and what rank you attain, we breed this high school mentality. And that's, I mean, we're sitting here at
age. Well, tell me, can you evaluate a porta shitter now? Because when I was younger and before I think I went to the Middle East, I never, you know, I didn't like them. Now I love them. It feels like home. Like, yeah. And, I, you know, you can see, does it have the urinal trough? Does it have,
you can rate
does it have the shock absorber seat so it doesn't slam? You know, does it have a good lock or is it kind of a chintzy ghetto-ass lock? You know, so you and they, I mean, there's some nice Portishes out there.
Right.
So.
And I regret, although I was a little busy fighting at the time, in multiple combat tours in the Middle East, my one regret is I could have saved myself a lot of editing if I would have just taken pictures of all the graffiti and funny things that Marines and soldiers wrote on the inside of all of those blue Port-a-johns. That would have been a bestseller.
That's
like, instead, I had to write, you know, one with 300 actual words I had to write and edit to become a best-selling author. But I think, I don't know what the title would have been, but it would have been fabulous. And I think every Marine would have one on their coffee table today. I wonder if there's like a Davis Monthan airplane graveyard for Port-a-johns. I could maybe go there. See, I'm giving away trade secrets.
No,
now.
You might.
There's going to be some guy.
There's some literature.
Where do all the Port-a-johns go to die? And there's a lot of wisdom in there, and along with profanity, but
and a fair amount of harassment too.
Our last
which would get him painted.
Our last interview was
where are you going with all that paint? Like, we're painting the shitters, sir. What? Oh yeah, Gunny said we got to paint the shitters because the colonel went in there and saw something like.
Right. Our last interview was so much more professional. This is like
this is good.
This is typical of. What I just described is you get two Marines in rooming together, and it quickly devolves into a high school mentality. And
it's our life.
It is.
It's our life.
It is.
The all right. So you do you do Desert Storm. Do you re-enlist? How do you find your way to college? How do you find your way to become an officer?
Well, I think another huge lesson I learned when I was enlisted is I did, as everyone does, have examples of what bad leadership looks like, and I thought if I really wanted to lead, if I really want to stay in the Marine Corps, which I thought I did, I always loved it, loved being a Marine, I needed to get an education. So I got off active duty. I was lucky because I also was a machine gunner. I was an O331, and there was a weapons company in Waukegan, Illinois. And I went to school at Illinois State, again, not an easy school to get into. I'm not saying it's the Harvard of Illinois. But,
ISU.
I think maybe Northwestern is the Harvard of Illinois. Anyway, I got in, drilled while I was in college, and again, a young, motivated sergeant in the recruiting office called me up, and he says, we can get you a boat seat at OCS in January. There was a huge hiring freeze going on with the U.S. Marshals Service. There's one federal agency I wanted to get into. And there was no way I was going to bartend or wait tables for another year. So I said, absolutely. It's something I've always wanted to do. But, you know, there was that risk factor. And notwithstanding my lifestyle of high-risk behavior,
right.
Job security was pretty important to me because, I wanted to stay in the infantry. And I loved, being enlisted. And, being a machine gunner in reserves was fun. But I wanted to be in the infantry. And then when you go to the basic school, as you know, having taught there and been a student, there's lots of jobs with, zeros and threes and twos in them. So it's all performance-based. And luckily, I guess through my performance, not everyone makes it into the infantry. It sounds,
it
sounds like they let everybody in.
They do.
Do they let everybody in?
Everybody. You can't get enough.
That's a dark secret.
No, but by the time, everybody, a lot of people show up talking, I think I'm going to go infantry. I mean, one thing about Quantico is that it's a miserable place. No matter what time of year you go there, it's cold and wet in the winter, and it's hot, humid, and bug-filled in the summer, and you're going to be miserable there. And so you get poked in the face enough with sticks, right? And you do enough misery in the cold, wet. The faint of heart will say, yeah, I'm not doing this, man. I'll go artillery, And so,
Well, you see that rapid, it's not a crescendo. It goes the opposite way. Like, we're all my infantry guys at the beginning of TBS, and there's massive cacophony of, like, hoorah. And then by D week, it's muted a little bit. And then by the war, it's like, we're all my grunts. It's like, hoorah. One guy. It's like, and then the other 40 guys that, selected to get
and all the grunts for all the billet holders.
Absolutely.
Because everybody else is, like, shutting it down. Sir, I'm going to be a Hawk missile officer. What do I need to be outside for? I'll never be outside again. All right, you shut up, okay? Who's the next one? So you want to be a grunt. You get out, and in 2 minutes, give us your kind of your migration through your career as an officer, and then we'll come back to we'll talk, because I want to talk why right and things like that. So
yeah,
give us a condensed version of your billets, and then we'll kind of talk about your book here.
Very fortunate. I was either a Marine or leading Marines my entire 24 years, either enlisted or officer. As an officer, when I got commissioned, 29 Palms, all the company billets. I was very fortunate. 2 years as a platoon commander, which is almost unheard of.
Yeah,
well. XO, moved on to Fast Company. So, again, I was like a platoon commander on steroids, always condition one, forward deployed, multiple deployments with the anti-terrorism security team in the Middle East and Baghdad and also in the Mediterranean, doing a lot of cool stuff, which was cool at the time and still is because they have a great mission. School, company command, and, OPSO, EXO, assistant OPSO, MU, you name it. And then it got to that point in my career where, being injured and, physically, I think, probably caught up with me. And you see things on the horizon, you understand that there's a certain, series of cubicle jobs maybe in your future or a lot of moves, and I just made the decision that, hey, when it stops being fun, I have to move on and do something else and challenge myself, which I think is important because as you transition and as you move through the Marine Corps, which they're always moving to you, they teach you to challenge yourself. So I always say to guys, that's part of being a Marine, is leaving the Marine Corps is a challenge in and of itself, because a lot of guys hang on and they become this cannon fodder that does not serve the organization. And we know who those guys are. They're easy to detect because our bullshit meters are so finely calibrated after 20 years in the Marine Corps. But so I decided to move on and transition and, work in the private sector for a while, but I'd always wanted to write. And people often ask, why did you tell this story? Because they're absolutely just like you have certain points in your career that you would define as pinnacles. This point in my career as a company commander in Ramadi in 2006 and 2007 was absolutely a pinnacle of my career. I mean, for an infantry guy, it doesn't get any cooler or any more challenging or any more dynamic than what we experienced over the months and weeks in Ramadi, fighting day in and day out, 4, 5, 6, 7 times a day in direct contact with the enemy, leading some of the best men, the best Marines and soldiers that I've ever known. I mean, these guys were just phenomenal. And to this day, I'm so proud of everything they did because I was always challenging them to do such superhuman acts every single day, and they never let me down. And they took care of each other better than anything else I've ever seen. And that's something that I always smile about to this day. It always makes me a little bit you could call me sentimental, but I love seeing Marines taking care of other Marines, whether it's another wounded Marine or whether they're just sitting around feeding each other because one forgot his chow back in the vehicle or something. It makes me smile, and that's really been my journey in probably over 2 minutes, but it got us talking about how I came to writing through my entire 24-year career to where I'm at now, to be able to share Echo and Ramadi as a tribute to the Marines that fought and sacrificed and died, but also to their families. And, that's really the important part as we've launched the book and been so successful, is we were talking at lunch too, is that the book's not just another war story. It's about the people and these families. And I think that the families, the moms, the wives, the Gold Star parents, the Blue Star families, they need to read this book to really understand how important it was for me to capture that. It's the first chapter. I mean, there's chapters, entire chapters written about this. That's why it was so important to me to describe not only what the Marines sacrificed, because we raise our hand and take an oath to fight, but we also leave behind our families, and some don't come home. And that's extremely important to me. That's why there's never been anything written like this that goes into as much detail. And when I interviewed those family members, my Gold Star families, my Blue Star families, I wanted to make sure that I told their story right. And every time I get a phone call or an email from one of them saying that I did, it makes it very worthwhile that I dedicated my time to this.
What, so you said you'd always wanted to write. Talk to me about that. Where did that come from? Because, you know, 1.24 GPA in high school.
1.24. What?
That's normally a non, right? Look, just in my in my high school experience, the guys at that end of the spectrum, they were, like, you needed wood stacked someplace. You could.
I don't think I was.
They would steal part of it.
That's probably what I was. That's how I'm gonna. That's gonna be my new line for the defend my 1.2 for GPA, which I exposed myself. I'm guilty of.
Yeah, it's.
I don't think I was challenged.
Don't run from it.
Yeah, but I was. I think I was a little artistic, left brained, one of the creative types.
Oh.
And in college, I did excel. When I went to school, you know, graduated in 3 years.
Wow.
Which, you know, is only a testament to the discipline I learned as a young enlisted Marine.
But it's interesting to hear how many Mustangs graduate in less than 4 years and say the exact same thing.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I had a job. I had something I was aiming for, whether it was a commission or something else, and I wanted to get on with my life, and I knew how to work. And I knew how to be disciplined. I had a job, you know, whether it was tenant bar or working at a store. I went to school. I studied, and I did well. It wasn't hard because I had learned discipline, you know, in my life. I knew how to do it, and I still had a good time doing it. But I wasn't afraid to work. So it's interesting that's a fairly common
yeah.
thing.
That's what drove me through it. But even in school, I think I was interested in fine art. I did some fine art work, printmaking. But it takes a lot of equipment, so I think the artistic side lingered. So the medium of writing was a way to express myself, and I think it's, you know, it's important to share stories. And I've never been one of those people that wanted to complain. I'm sure people will argue this point, Sam, but don't complain without a solution. And I always was willing to write about that, whether it was in the you know, scholarly journals, or whether it was even just keeping good notes so I could back up, you know, factual events. It was always important to me to be able to articulate myself. And I think probably writing is a very mobile artistic form, so you can do it anywhere. And that's where it led me. And I think that my success is someone that's been able to be a storyteller, to educate people and to speak to people about my experiences and the experience of others. I feel very fortunate that I'm able to do that. It's really through that medium that's brought a lot of other people together. And when you write a book, you don't normally see that. And you don't think about that when you're creating something, whether it's a picture on a wall, whether it's a book on a shelf, you're impacting so many people. And we were talking about this, like the present you got hanging on your wall behind me is you don't realize, and this is an art form too, being on radio is not everybody has the capability, and you should be proud of that. And I think more military service members understand, like, this is something you can do if you're really interested in doing it and willing to expose yourself a little bit too, because that's tough, as you know, because when you're behind this microphone, you're kind of safe, but you throw it out there and it's out there for everyone to see or to read, but you reach so many people like you do through radio. And the email that I shared with you at lunch from this random staff sergeant in the Army that reached out to me, talking to me about reading Echo and Ramadi and how important that was to him and how grateful he was that I had shared that part of the book with him about Corporal Libby was just, I mean, literally almost brought me to tears from some staff sergeant who I probably passed 100 times in the command center, but read the book and told me how important it was to him that I wrote about my Gold Star families and that I remembered that Marine. It's just really impactful.
The my guest today is, would you retire from the Marine Corps as? Major?
Major.
retired Marine Corps Major Scott Husing, and he has a book out. It's a bestseller. It's called Echo in Ramadi, about Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines in Ramadi in 2006. Where? How'd you think of the title?
Yeah, that's an unfair question.
Yeah, explain it, though.
I'm glad you asked that question. It's
not a small, insignificant part of the book, right?
No, it's the title, and there's it's obviously a play on words. I mean, Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, and when you read the book and you go through the story, you'll understand that, it is absolutely about the fighting and the friction and everything the Marines experience and the families that supported us while we fought. And that still continues to support us this day through some of the darkness, you know, that we battle and the grim effects of post-traumatic stress and suicide and those echoes that we, you know, hear to this day. And we're not able to unsee some of the things that we've seen or undo some of the things that we've done, some of the effects of war that are created by, you know, humans. And that's a tough thing. So, the title of the book came to me, and there was a point during the process when you go through the publishing process through a big publishing house like Regnery, they didn't understand it. And I don't say this disparagingly whatsoever, is that they, you know, obviously a book has to sell, so they wanted a book title that people would understand. And so there was almost an explanation that needed to be told. But I think at the end of the day, how I won this small battle was I said to the team, you know, I'm sure there was a point in time where people hadn't heard words like Guadalcanal or Quezon or Way, but they made it on to the covers of book titles or articles, so it's important to me. And the reason it was important to me, we were just talking about this earlier, is that the importance of Ramadi, I never wanted that to fall into the shadows of other significant battles like Fallujah's or the Baghdad's or the Kandahar's. It is an important battle, and it was one that started in 2004, as we discussed. And we thought we were done then, and then we handed the city back over, and then we were back again in 2006. So it's really a two-year battle, and we're going to talk about that in our next battlefield study and follow up with Lieutenant Colonel Bronzy, who fought in Ramadi in 04. He talked about it. It's out there right now. Great podcast. And then I'm going to come back and talk about how it was in 06, and we're going to try and tie all that together. But that's where the title came from, is, it's Echo Company in Ramadi. But it digs a lot deeper. There's a lot of play on words there. But I really want listeners to understand, especially the non-military ones that tune into your show, is how important that city was as the capital of Alamar Province, and why the insurgents, not just the local insurgents, but the ones that were recruited in to fight and kill Americans, wanted to fight us in that city because it was key terrain. And as we sit here with a map of it in front of us, both of us can understand how dynamic that place was and how fluid and really uncontrollable it was as we fought day in and day out. It really was the epitome of the word chaos and friction that I use sometimes in Echo and Mighty as a complete paragraph. Friction. Just this indescribable pressure that is constantly around us that we have limited control over but impacts us so much. That's what we were dealing with. And you don't have control over that. And when you don't have control over things as a Marine, it's an uncomfortable situation. But that's really where we're fortunate to have the brotherhood, the training, the gear, the equipment, and the technology that sustained us on the battlefield as we fought day in and day out.
I heard a great friction story. I'll share it with you real quick. Planning an operation for a couple weeks, a deliberate operation to clear down a road that we haven't been able to clear, only maybe a couple hundred meters, because securing the bridge is significant so that if we take any casualties on the far side of the bridge, we can, you know, make sure we can medevac them. So we haven't cleared very far for that reason. It's been problematic. So this whole thing, fire support locked on, you know, the Afghan army locked on, everybody ready to go. We're going to LD at 05. standing there getting ready to go. Contracts are done. 15 minutes. All of a sudden, a whole series of taillights appears on the route that's going right in front of the firm base, right through the town to wake everybody up. Who is that? What are they doing? No idea. It's a transcom convoy transiting through the city en route to someplace else. Do we still LD? Because the whole city's awake now. Everybody's looking because they think it looks like it's coming to the firm base, but they're not. They're passing through. Well, I've got this whole thing locked on. What do I do? So they LD and they execute the LD. Right? So you work all this time to get there, you get ready, and then these random things happen. Vehicles don't run. Radios all of a sudden stop working right when you need them.
Yeah.
So when you hear the term friction,
I think amazing. You could. How many of us have so many stories similar to that? And you know,
it made me laugh when he's telling it.
Well, we can sit here for the whole rest of the week and just throw names around, and it's just like Marines do. But there's so many of those stories I could have written about, and so many Marines and soldiers I could have written about. And I think one of my Marines said, "Hey, sir, you didn't write about this, and you didn't write about this." I get these emails, and I say, "Well, man, I can't write about everything. You know, it's only one book, and if I wrote 10,000 pages, no one would ever read it." So the important thing is that those stories that I shared, the good ones and the bad ones, and even the ones that are kind of humorous under the worst conditions, I think they're, again, emblematic of what all of us experience under those type of conditions where you just don't have any control, and that friction is constantly rubbing you, constantly. You don't really even know where it's coming from. And the people that are dealing with these situations, even though I write about my Marines, it's emblematic of what all of us experience and everybody dealt with, because it is timeless. I mean, war is timeless. We were sitting at lunch and through our conversations talking about every generation of war and how all those things continue to repeat themselves. And I think this generation too is doing the same things that we did when we fought. I mean, they're still fighting today. They're in Afghanistan, they're in Iraq today, they're in the Horn of Africa, and they're crushing it. They are doing it today. I was on the phone this week with a good friend of mine, just got back from Iraq. One of my interpreters, who was with me in Ramadi, called me. Wow. He just got back from Iraq. He's now an American citizen, by the way, who I write about in Echo and Ramadi, and he's now a high-level Defense Department interpreter. And he's serving our country in official capacity. Not that he wasn't serving it then as a contracted interpreter, but now he's just over 30 and he's still doing it though. I mean, where do these guys come from? It's amazing.
Those are awesome.
That's such a huge
life-changing stories, right?
Yeah.
Life-changing story. I want to ask you, Scott, when I see the cover of the book, right, and I see the title of the book, I'm a bit surprised that you talk about how broad the book is in terms of covering families and Gold Star families and your Blue Star families and things like that. And so I'm curious in terms of who's the book written for?
It's written for all of them. I think I had this specifically in mind. And I know you look at the cover of the book and you see this badass door kicker on there. And
it's a monster. It's an awesome picture.
Yeah, it's a great cover. I mean, you can't deny it. They did a great job designing the cover, which I had a small hand in. I can't say I didn't, but, at the end of the day, if I put a bouquet of tulips on there, no one would buy it. Or, the people that picked it up wouldn't understand it. It has to tie together, but that's why I think it's important that I talk about it on great shows like yours that, hey, don't let the cover fool you. And I'm very fortunate to have a lot of female supporters who've read this, who've gotten behind it and said, you have to read this book. We do judge books by its cover, but this story is so important to honor the families and the moms and dads that supported us. The cover can't sum everything up. And Otherwise, it would have been a collage of photos of all the great people that impacted my life, not only during the Battle of Ramadi, but throughout my career. And that would have been, you know, something tough to do. So you have to hone it down at some point, and to have people understand that. And I think the feedback I've gotten on the book itself has been from those people from all different demographics, to include battle-hardened Marines calling me up saying, hey, thanks for making me cry on a plane ride next to a total stranger, you know, and explicative, you know, dropping an F-bomb. And I'm like, you're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Because
I think I wanted you to talk about that because the breadth of the book is much broader than most books are that deal with war. Most books, you know, I think, while they may allude to dependents and family members and things like that, they don't focus and tell that story as broadly as you do with your book. Why was that important? Why is that an important piece of Echo and Ramadi?
Well, I wouldn't say I'd describe them broadly. I'd say that I'd talk about the people because these are individual people that I think exemplify those categories. So I just don't want to communicate that is, you know, I don't talk about them in broad terms by definition. These are people that fall into these groups.
What I was trying to say was your brushes is not, you paint a much more complete picture of the experience.
Because those stories haven't been told. Those stories have to be told. That's how their legacy lives on. That's how people learn to support not only our veterans and reach out and say, hey, thank you for your service, but they see a gold star bumper sticker on a car and they stop and they say thank you to our gold star families, or a blue star on a car and say thank you for providing our nation with the finest young warriors to wear this uniform. Those stories haven't been told. So that's why it was important for me to make sure that throughout the chapters of fighting and the battles and the tactics and all the sexy stuff that's normally associated with, you know, the Battle of Ramadi, is that there's a team aspect to not only those that fight on the battlefield, but those that support us. And that was absolutely critical to me. I mean, the first book is about the phone call I had to make to the mother of a squad leader that we lost on December 6th, Corporal Dustin Libby. And it was the first chapter that I wrote. That's really, I won't say that's what lit the fuse for me to write this book, but when I thought about when I'm going to write my book, your first book, what are you going to write? Well, everybody's got a book in this day, but that was how important this was to me, is probably that singular moment as I pressed the power button on that Iridium satellite phone to call the parents of a 22-year-old Marine. You know, that's what was so impactful. That's what made me write. That's what I had to express. And again, I'm not one of these guys that will say, writing this book and sharing my emotions and my pain and my failures and my humanity was some catharsis for me. I don't think I'm one of those guys. Maybe I just won't admit it. But I think I did it because this book is different. It shows the connection, this brotherhood that we talked about. Like, me and you were just pen pals until we met today. We go to lunch, but it feels like we picked up where we left off 6 years ago, and that's how Marines are. That's where the brotherhood is different than from other specially trained groups, these elite groups that get a lot of coverage. And what's remarkable about that is it was, as I said, my book talks about the brotherhood not only while we fought, but how it continues to this day. And my good friend Robert Vera, who wrote Warrior's Faith, brought that to my attention. But he said, Scott, your book is so different. Because there's a lot of books that talk about, yeah, I was in Special Forces here, I did this, I was with this unit, and this is what we did while we fought. But you talk about how you're still connected to your Marines, what they're doing now, in this lifelong commitment of leadership that you have long after you left the Marine Corps, long after you left that company. But again, not just being a bumper sticker, once a Marine, always a Marine, Robert says to me, who was never in the military, he says, once a leader, always a leader. He said, and I felt that when I read your book, is that you're so connected to these Marines. And it's not just the Marines of Echo Company. I think there's plenty of units I served in that I still feel very connected to those Marines that I led. And I just think that coming from a guy that barely made it out of high school, ran from the cops, got thrown in jail, was fighting all the time, drinking underage, to have the Marine Corps transform me in the way that only the Marine Corps can transform a person and take a kid that I was and turn him into a United States Marine to the point of success that I've enjoyed, not that I've earned. I just enjoyed it because it's been through the people and this network that you and I know. And that's so wide when you leave the Marine Corps. That's why I'm so fortunate, and that's why I feel that need to stay connected. It's just really important to me.
Can you tell the story of Echo and Normandy without telling the story of your Blue Star and Gold Star families? Because one of the things that, you know, I think surprises people when they, you know, when people ask questions, you know, what's the scariest part? And I know when I answer, hugging your wife and your kids and not knowing if you'll ever hug them again. And, you know, the stuff we do professionally, you know, we're good at it. We understand it. You know, we're the best in the world at it. And we believe that as a statement of fact, not as a statement of bravado, because we know how hard we work. But when you hug your daughter and, you know, depending on how old they are, they have the same thoughts going through their head that you have. Am I ever going to see them again? And they don't hug you normally. They dig their fingers. I'm going through it in my head as I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
They dig their fingers into your shoulders, and they, you know, they say things like, you know, Daddy, I don't want you to go. And the terrifying nature that I'm not going to see my little princess again, or my two little men, I'm not going to see them again. I don't know that I could ever adequately describe the terror and what it's like the night that you leave, how emotionally draining when everybody finally gets on the bus.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, when you, for instance, leave in Pendleton, I don't know, we're even out the back gate of Fallbrook and the whole bus is asleep because you're just emotionally worn out. And how, so if you don't tell that side of the story, you're getting a crescent of the story. Maybe not more
that's
than a crescent.
Great, that's a great point.
But it is, and that's why, to me, you know, one of the things your book tells that part of the story. And I think that's why the audience ought to be broader, and men and women ought to read it, because it's the human story, not simply the combat story. That's one of the things I enjoy about your book, because I mean it speaks to me like that. I mean you can hear me. I mean I still remember the weeks before leaving in 2006, and for my second deployment to Iraq, and thinking, you know, in 10 days I got to do that. You know, in 8 days I've got to do that. Tomorrow I've got to do that. And I've got to be strong because I know they're going to struggle with it. And then completely falling apart in the shower, you know, that I took so that they would recognize that I was getting ready to cry. Going up the stairs and, you know, and then you lose it because you've seen it, right? You've seen it. Like when you went to Ramadi, you'd seen it before. So you know there's a randomness on the battlefield that you don't control, you know. And I remember when I get on the plane, I'd say what Jesus said on the cross, you know, into your hands I command my spirit, because it's out of your control once you get on the plane. You don't know if you're coming back, and so I think that family part, that human side, and the hard part, the burden I think that a lot of us carried going forward is that you're putting your family through that. Right?
Yeah.
And that's a heavy burden when they're old enough to know, and you don't want to talk about it before you leave, but you all have the same thought. Is he going to come home? Am I ever going to see him again? So, I mean, no, I just want to compliment you on that's an important part of the story because, again, I last said goodbye to my family in 2010, 2018 right now, so coming up on 8 years, and it still affects me. You know, you could hear it in my voice. If you were sitting here, you'd see the tears in my eyes. When I tell the story and I think of the terrifying thought that I'm not going to see my kids, I'm not going to see my wife ever again, or once you get there, when you see somebody get disfigured, you're like, he just got his the lower part of his jaw shut off. He just lost his jaw. And you see these things for the first time, or you see somebody get burned horribly, and you think, I don't want that to happen to me. Like, you know, what am I going to, you know, what happens to me after that? And so that is the human side of this business.
It is. It's a dangerous job, and having to, you know, go through all that trauma. I mean, notwithstanding the horrific things you see on the battlefield, I don't think a lot of people realize, you know, when we talk about post-traumatic stress and all the really high-end things that lead people to that problem of hopelessness that leads to suicide that we were just talking about. But there are traumatic events, like being ripped away from your family is trauma. And then being in battle, being in combat, seeing the things that we have to see, having to squeeze the trigger of a rifle and take another human life, having to drop a bomb on a house full of people, having to see what the brutal insurgents did to the local civilians to promote their hateful ideology to support their caliphate, and what they did in their murderous campaign. It was horrific, the things that they did to their own people to support their own ideology. So as you go through all that and you begin to compartmentalize that, and I love the jack-in-the-box example. I used a jam example, you know, obviously, of how you compartmentalize those pieces of trauma. But I don't think you should ever discount the ones from the family aspect as well, because, I mean, honestly, I never even counted those ones. Like, oh, those don't count. Those aren't real traumas. These are real traumas. Car accidents, explosions, gunfights, murder, dead bodies, you know, burned children, you know, those are traumatic experiences. But those little things all add up too. And that's why, despite, you know, sharing the stories of the families that shared with me about their pain and loss, it was also important to me to write about the things that I went through. Because when you pull pain and emotion from 75 of your friends and family members, you know, there comes a point in time when you got to look at yourself in the mirror as an artist, as a writer, and say, I got to give it myself. And I did that. And I think that it was, again, helpful to me. I think it was being true to my craft, so to speak, as a writer. And I think now, having gotten such great feedback from all the Marines that I served with and from all the fans and followers of this book, I think it's been great because, again, it really humanized me. I think that the Marines now see me as Scott Husing, not Captain Husing, which is kind of cool. I mean, it really is, because I get these random emails from the boys and they say, sir, I had no idea. Just as I had no idea as a Lance Corporal in Desert Storm. They didn't realize all those, you know, those outside pressures that were coming down on me that I was shielding.
No, he's the CO.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You're the CO.
Yeah.
What is that? It's an iconic image, especially if you can live up to it and be that. If you can be that guy, if you can be that girl, that when they talk about their CO, yeah, he's my CO. You earn that title. You are the CO by virtue of your billet. You become their CO by virtue of merit. And they know it, and you can't fake your way into it.
Now we smell fear. We're like dogs, you know. We can sniff out our own. And,
right. And we watch, and Marines watch all the time. And you know who can hang, and you know who can't hang. You know who you can't, and you can't sugarcoat it when you're doing what you're doing. So.
Well, you know, we talk about wearing that mask of command. I think everybody does. I think we all do to some degree. I like to think that I was as connected and as authentic with my men and women as possible when I had the privilege to command. But now to be able to write about it and to really, you do at this stage of your life, you know, it's just one of those things, you enjoy this privilege. Like you're the old guy sitting in the library and you're loud and you're talking, like, hey, he's 80. He gets to do whatever he wants. So, you know, I'm not 80, you know, I'm not close to it, but,
you're getting there.
Yeah. Not as close as you, but,
I'm almost
you
there.
You enjoy that, that autonomy, so to speak, to really expose your faults. And I think that by doing that, when we started talking earlier about, hey, what was your lesson you learned as a young Lance Corporal? Like, now as a retired major with, you know, being retired for over 4 years almost, which is crazy, you know, what is my lesson learned from writing this book and sharing this story is, it's such an amazing adventure to be honest with yourself and to be able to expose yourself that allows other people to heal. Because everybody deals with trauma in their life, and not everybody deals with it in the same way. And if you can help one, or you can help 100, or you can help 100,000 people by having shared a part of yourself, that's a real eye-opener to understand that and realize that this may just be one story, but it's one great military story that helps serve as this portal for other guys to heal. And if I've gotten one, I've gotten, you know, 1,000 emails from guys that I didn't even know. Some I knew, but others that say, thank you for remembering us. Thank you for telling the story, because it was important and we did make a difference. And I think that comes through page after page when you read not only about the families and the fighting, but the people that understand and they connect with that. It's been a real life lesson for me, I think, overall, to be able to share the story.
My guest this morning is retired Marine Major Scott Husing. He is the author of a newly published book. It's a bestseller. It's called Echo in Ramadi, the firsthand story of U.S. Marines in Iraq's deadliest city. And I think you can ask anybody in Al Anbar, any Marine that ever served in Iraq, what the deadliest city was, and I think they'll all tell you the same thing. It was Ramadi, because it was on in Ramadi, starting in the early spring of 2004, four plus years until the surge. We're going to take a break. More with Scott coming up next right here on All Marine Radio. Don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue. The book is called Echo in Ramadi. The author is Major Scott Husing, retired United States Marine Corps infantryman. And Scott continues with us. So, Scott, first of all, again, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Okay. I'm going to read I made Scott forward me an email that he alluded to earlier, and I want to share it with everybody. Because I just want to underline the point that it's not your average telling of a story of combat, all right? Echo Ramadi's a broader story than that, and I think because of that, you should buy it and you should read it, and we're going to talk about what it has in it for different sectors of the audience. But let me just share this the email with you. Sir, I'm sure you don't remember me, but I remember you well. I was a staff sergeant in the Task Force 19 Infantry S1 Shop the night when Corporal Libby was shot. I remember getting the call on the radio, running across Route Michigan to the aid station, the Humvees rolling in through the maze of chem lights, and the dust cloud as the trucks came to a hard stop. I was there when your Marines carried Libby in and watched everything unfold. As I read the first chapter of Echo in Ramadi, I remembered your every step that night, the look on your face, on everyone's faces. Things I haven't thought about in years came flooding back. Yes, we were part of something important. Those are sacred. That's a sacred place.
It's hard not to read that even and get a little emotional.
No, because the detail that he writes, even in the email, the maze of chem lights as you come through the barriers, right? The dust that comes up, the urgency when you get through that to move quickly, the doors flying open, right? And the urgency in people's voices and the look of intensity on their face. And the next part is the tremendous look of concern for a close, close friend who's fighting for his life. All of that, and I think he does a great job in articulating that in the email.
You can tell a story having been there and through interviews like I did in Echo and Ramadi, but when you get a response like that from someone, again, who I've probably passed by him, 100 times, to see it through their eyes, that reflection, that's a reflection of something that you shared about your life, but a perspective also that you've never been able to look in the mirror at. And to get that they're the most meaningful endorsements of Echo and Ramadi, far more important to me than any 7-star general or celebrity could ever give, because these are the people that understand it the best. These soldiers, these Marines, my Marines, and the families that supported us, they're really the ones that understand the most. But that's, again, why I wrote it, was to explain that type of experience, that type of visceral, raw, unvarnished nature of war, and the people that are involved in it and get pulled into it as well. That's why I shared the story. That's why I wanted everybody to read the book.
When you write, one of the difficult things about writing is you write something and then you hand it to somebody and you say, what's the most important idea in what you just read? And you know what you're writing, hopefully to have them say. And one of the challenges of writing is when they look at you and they tell you something that is not even close to what you intended. And you have to go back and say, you know what, I need to craft this different because that's not like, and then you read it from and you think, oh, okay, I can see how they see that. It must feel awfully good when your writing hits the intended target.
It does. It does. It validates, not only locking myself in a room for a year to hammer away and write Echo and Ramadi, but the work that most don't understand goes into editing and publicity and giving more of yourself to ensure that the story is told. And I think there's a lot of people with great stories, and they've tried, and they get beat down by the process. Because it's work, man. Yeah. It really is work. And you have to go into this process as a career and not a hobby. If it's a hobby, it's just something you do on the weekends. But that's how committed I was to share this story, is that I turned the switch and I made it a full-time job and a mission, like every Marine does. And I was going to set deadlines for myself, which I met, just like time on target. These had to be done by this time. These interviews had to be done, every week. I needed an agent by this date, and I achieved all those goals, and we've been so successful. But to get the feedback, like you said, Mike, that you got it right, that is the most important thing. It really is.
Talk to us about different segments of the audience that will look at this. For military guys, when they read this, what are they going to find in Echo and Ramadi?
They'll find themselves. Again, it's very emblematic of what everybody experienced, not only in Ramadi, but in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, Korea. So any veteran out there that's listening, they've they'll read it. People have read this book, Veterans, and they thank me again for explaining that and sharing that connection and that bond that they hadn't thought about in so many years, that bond and special brotherhood that is very unique to the Marine Corps and to the families that want to understand what these Marines and soldiers endured, to see it through their eyes, to look through their eyes and hear it from them, because it really is their stories that tell my story as well, because they're the ones that supported me. I mean, they took care of each other better than anything, but they also took care of me. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here today if it wasn't for the fighting spirit of my guys and the fact that they went after the enemy like no one's business and, you know, relentlessly knocked them back on their heels. And, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for those guys. So people understand what their sacrifice meant. They'll understand what the sacrifices of those families that we hug and leave behind. Because those interviews that I do with my Gold Star moms like Diane Layfield and Jenny Libby and Janie Sanchez and Joey Sanchez and Nikki Licky and Bob Licky, these are real people. These are my family.
What about Gold Star families and Blue Star families? What do they get out of Echo and Ramadi?
I think, again, it's part of this extended family that we continue to talk about and this amazing network of support, and very fortunate to be a part of our Gold Star network. People like Sue Pollard, who's the president, and Diane Layfield, who's such a strong advocate, and her son, Travis Layfield, that died in Ramadi in 04, his story is in Echo and Ramadi as well, because she's a big part of that, because one of my Marines was best friends with their son in the book. And it's important to me to talk about that, because I want all the Gold Star families to always remember that they're never forgotten. And again, we were talking earlier in the program, it's great to say thanks for your service to a veteran, but I wonder how many people go up to a Gold Star parent and say, I'm sorry for your loss. And I don't think people understand and really recognize what a Gold Star parent is and the indescribable tragedy that I can't imagine of losing your child. And that's why I say that they're just extraordinary people, to lose so much, but to continue to love us so much and shine this light to help people like me and my Marines and all those who are still battling with that darkness of losing their brothers, because we understand they lost their son or daughter, but we lost our brothers and sisters as well. So there's a connection. But to be able to share their story, to be lucky enough to let them in my life and for them to let me share their story, that's something special. It really is. And I don't think that I could have done it without their support. I mean, I picked up the phone, I always say this, probably 20, 30 times, and called Bob and Nikki Licky to ask them if it was all right to talk about their son, Simon, who was one of my squad leaders as well, but we lost Simon to suicide in 2015 when he took his own life. And every time I called them, they said, Scott, you have to tell this story. People need to understand what happens. These are our sons and daughters and brothers and husbands and wives, and these are our nation's heroes that we're losing to the effects of post-traumatic stress and suicide, and we have to make these connections, whether it's with our veterans, whether it's with those who serve, whether it's the Marines, whether it's with our families or our Gold Star families. These connections are what heal us. I mean, there's no pill or vaccination that can be prescribed that's any better than connecting with people that truly understand what you're going through.
The other part is nobody heals completely. I mean, so the thing is that there's a bit of coping. You know, there's some healing involved, but I think, and Scott and I were talking during the break about the best advice I've ever received, and it came from a gunnery sergeant by the name of Lance Y. after a helicopter crash in which four Marines were killed, and that my company was involved with, that I was involved with. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you're never going to get over this. And I just thought it was the stupidest thing anybody could say, and I told him that, using the F word about 30 times in a 35 word sentence. But it was the oral tradition of mental health coping.
Yeah.
That was inside the Marine Corps that I didn't really know about, that he shared with me. And I've never felt bad when I've gotten emotional, like today, because, you know, he told me, he said, hey, you can't live through this stuff without it sticking to you, and it's going to bother you. And so healing has its own context here, in terms of, you know, I cannot imagine, losing my son or my daughter and the hole that I would feel in my heart. And yet, as you said, you know, the strength you get from other people, the strength you get from sharing the story, why they would be such advocates for you is something you can only understand when you walk in their moccasins for, you know, for a little while.
Yeah.
And I commend you for doing that, because again, it's pulling the curtain back. And, you know, just like we were talking a little bit ago about the terror.
And you need
the
permission. I feel like...
You go into the inner sanctum.
When you're going to pull the curtain back like that, you have to get permission, too. And
well,
I think,
bottom line is what? You would never do it because it's a Bushido violation.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
You would,
yeah, it's something...
Sacred.
And that's what people need to understand, is that these stories aren't told because they're difficult to tell. To even broach the subject with somebody that has gone through what our goals, our families go through, the courage I think that I had to find in myself to first even ask was probably the biggest challenge, because it is something that is sacred. I mean, it's sacred between fellow Marines and our families, but to a father and a son, or a mother and her son. I mean, that's absolutely sacred. So when these people, these extraordinary people, were so willing to share this, because they're part of my family. They're like me. They understand that more people need to understand what goes on in this country about this small segment of our population of less than one half of 1% of 330 million people that are willing to volunteer, raise their hand, and put their lives on the line. And they realize that. And I think that, again, through my relationships and good fortune, they shared these stories with me, and they come through in Echo and Ramadi. And I think that's really what makes it, again, such a different story. It's not just my story. It's their story, too. And that was important for me to share.
What about people that have never been in the military, that aren't Gold Star parents, that aren't dependents, that kind of view the world that you and I called home, that view our tribe from afar, and are interested in it, respect it, or maybe don't respect it, but still are curious about it? And what will they get out of this book?
Well, the lessons that people get out of this book are timeless. And I think it doesn't matter what your affiliation is, what side of the aisle you sit on, what cross you pray to, there are lessons that come through in Echo and Ramadi about leadership, about team building, about overcoming adversity, and most importantly, that power of human connection that enabled us to fight and win in the bloody streets of Ramadi in 2006, but also they keep us so connected to this day. And to be an effective leader, to be someone that is going to inspire people to do things in your absence, in the face of great danger and uncertainty, at times when they don't want to do it, that's what you learn as you read not only my story, but how the Marines helped each other and how the families helped us as a unit. And this cohesion and this brotherhood, that bond, it's really the overarching emotional tie that every page of this book is bound by. It really is. It sounds a bit cliche, but I think that's the essence of the story. Is it's about that brotherhood and power of human connection. And, you know, it's also important, too, that, you know, I think, you know, we've talked about a lot of some of the harder aspects of combat and some of the tougher choices, you know, I had to make as an artist when I wrote. But there's also a lot in the book that's exciting, and there's a lot that's humorous, that we find the levity in some of the worst conditions. And the pure enjoyment, again, of seeing Marines and soldiers take care of each other, and the things that you'll read in this book where you think, God, man, I never thought that happened in real life, but it really happened. I thought that only happened in the movies. And then there's points where you'll read and you'll think, it's nothing like that in the movies. This is how it is in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is real life. It was my life. I mean, this is my life, and this has been a great journey. And to be able to share this story, this next part of my life has been an amazing, amazing journey. And it looks cooler on Facebook, you know, seeing all the running around and doing interviews. But I'm very fortunate, because without shows like All Marine Radio and other ones, they're so important to make sure that great military stories like this do not get marginalized in mainstream media. They're the future. The big ones, they're going to be gone. But if they don't figure out that they need to stop picking a side, and it's through programs like All Marine Radio and other great military podcasts and affiliates that help veterans, they help storytellers tell all these great tales. I mean, it's just amazing.
So, bottom line, though, for somebody who doesn't have any connection with the military at all, leadership, lessons in here, there's life lessons in here relative to coping and overcoming. So to me, you know, one of the cool parts about the book is that there's a strap for everybody.
There is.
And Echo and Ramadi that will connect you and will affect you as you go forward. Because, you know, a lot of, I heard somebody say, well, you know, given that kind of stress, isn't it only natural that everybody bonds? And the answer to that is no. No, that kind of stress with poor leadership can destroy a unit. It takes leaders that love people. And I'll quote Chris Bronzy again. Love isn't simply an emotion, it's a responsibility. And that we'll make sure that the right things get done to ensure that we achieve, to ensure that we accomplish missions, to ensure we take care of each other. Those aren't military lessons. You can apply those in business today. How do you do them? I think Echo and Ramadi is replete with examples of grace under pressure, humor under pressure, diffusing situations, that everybody can learn from. And so I think whether you were in the military or not matters not, and that there's so many great life lessons in the book. Give me one favorite leadership lesson out of the book. I know you're going to say, give me one favorite leadership lesson out of the book.
That's a good question. One favorite leadership lesson. I think that the biggest lesson, again, is knowing that there's a list of leadership traits and principles that we subscribe to, but it's going through those events and understanding who your people are, that you really understand those traits that are in between the lines. Those words like love and compassion and responsibility, that those are the leadership lessons that they can't teach you. The feeling that you get when you have to make those phone calls, or when you have to take a pause in the fight and put your arm around one of your fellow Marines to let them know it's going to be okay. Because you can see that guy. You can see how bad he's hurting, or how frustrated he is, how he just wants to throw it all in because he's working off of zero sleep for 3 days. And to be a good leader, to understand that and to be able to recognize that and not just go by the playbook, I think I found throughout my career, throughout my time in Ramadi as we fought in under those conditions, you're right. Those are timeless leadership lessons, whether you're in the battlefield or whether you're in the boardroom. Those lessons are timeless, and they're not just those lessons that apply there. But one of the things is that you're a leader when you leave, you know, not just while you're in a unit. And I think that's applicable outside of the Marine Corps, outside of the military. And a lot of corporations probably don't understand that. Is you move on and you advance, but that doesn't mean you stop leading those that you are tied to in those other departments or in those other levels. I think you maintain those ties and connections, and that's what has really been a secret of success is maintaining those relationships and those bonds has been the amazing part of this network of not just Marines, but all the people that support us, that support veterans, and there's tons of civilians and private sector companies that have supported us along the way, and that's really an amazing thing is understanding that that leadership needs to be constant, and it doesn't stop.
A lot of people raise their eyebrows when they hear Marines talk about leadership and use the L word. And they say, what are you guys like? You guys are Marines, man. What are you guys talking about, love? Yet everybody you hear talk about Marine Corps leadership uses the L word. And we shy away from words like intimacy and things like that. But I heard Jim Bathurst on last week, who Vietnam-era Marine, went from private to gunny, second lieutenant to colonel. So he got promoted a few times. And he said, you know, Mac, a friend of mine told me, you know, that although we hate to admit it, we've loved a lot more men than we have women. But it's true. I mean, and it is. And when you see people struggling and you reach out, I mean, that's what leadership is. You know, when you put your hand on your shoulder and you look at them and you say, hey, man, you're going to be okay. I know you're struggling now, but you see those pussies from World War II? They've been struggling for 70 years, man, so you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to struggle. Okay, but we're Marines, right? You just tell everybody you have allergies when your eyes get red, and then you go wash your face off, and then we go back after it, and we don't fail each other. And they look at you with such a sense of relief, like, hey, thanks, sir. How do you know? I pay attention, and I listen in the chow hall. That line in chow hall where we all stand in, some of your friends were talking, and so I figured I'd just say, hey, if you ever need to talk, don't be afraid, right? And look, and you know, I remember once doing an infusion, and a young, a 13-year-old boy had been killed in a blue-on-blue, a friendly firefight that, you know, they were trying to yoke up a mortarman, and two units converging, and luckily nobody was killed. But in the exchange down the street, a young boy had stopped on his bike to look and had been hit in the head. They ran to the street. Somebody sticks their thumb in his head to stop the bleeding, and they're screaming at the corpsman. The corpsman comes running down. Doc, you know, screaming at him, you got to save him, Doc. He's a little kid. Come on. And the doc just looked and said, "He's nothing I can do. He's dead." And, you know, just the anguish of, you know, why did this have to happen? Why did he stop it on his bike? Why didn't he keep going? And we're the good guys. We didn't come here to do this. Yet now, you know, this is another burden that we wear. Nobody saw him. He was hit by. And so how do you deal with that? How do you tell, you know, somebody young? And it's that, again, dare I say, the intimate, loving part of the Marine Corps that is where you truly do inspire, where you become their leader, where you reach out and you steady them and you give them the benefit of the wisdom that's been passed to you. And a little bit ago,
the oral history.
Yeah, the oral history of Jeremiah, don't let the monkeys out of the cage. And to me, you're never going to get over it. I've never gotten better advice in my life that's helped me more, that I passed on to more Marines. In fact, I remember a chaplain came up to me in Fallujah No, I was Ramadi, and he said, are you Major McNamara? And I covered my name tapes on my, I said, maybe, why, Chaplain? Does somebody owe you, does he owe you money? And he said, no, but I've talked to Marines who said, you tell them that they're never going to get over this. And I looked at him and I said, do you have a problem with that? He said, no. He said, I've started to use it, and I just want to come by and meet you. I said, well, you have to footnote it. Gunnery Sergeant Lance, why? And he got it from Vietnam-era Marines. That's where it comes from. And I said, it's the best advice I've ever gotten in my life, that you're damaged, but it's okay. You fought to be damaged. You're a Marine. You're a warrior. You're a special class of human on this planet. You're not a victim of anything, and that you should be proud, all right? And when you go to a party with a lot of guys with post-traumatic stress, Scott, is it a good party or what?
Pretty good party.
Pretty good party.
Whether you're in the military or first responder, I think if there's any class of people that you can attribute a resume builder as post-traumatic stress is, hey, what percentage is your post-traumatic stress? And you're like, 50% post-traumatic stress. And they say, great, what's your post-traumatic stress recovery rating? I'm 100%. And like, if you don't have that type of residue, that post-combat residue that I coined from Master Gunnery Sergeant Adam Walker, who wrote that great article, Post-Combat Residue, if you're not in that group of first responders or professional warriors, soldiers, Marines, and you don't experience that type of trauma, and you're not stained indelibly with that residue, you're not doing your job, first and foremost. But you can't be in those professions. You can't be in those highly kinetic combat environments and see death and destruction that is almost indescribable on the battlefield, or be a cop responding to the scene of a head-on collision, or a firefighter running into a building, pulling a burned child out, and not be affected by that, and not have some sort of post-traumatic residue. I don't care if you call it stress, or I think stress is just the response to the traumatic event. But you can't not be affected by that. But you move on.
I think it's important. It's normal. Right?
It's absolutely normal.
The abnormal response would not be affected.
Yeah, they're
by
called
it.
Sociopaths.
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah, they have no emotion and no remorse and no outlet to express their feelings. In this segment of our population, our first responders and military, like, they're unique because they're protectors. They take care of those that can't take care of themselves. And to put a stigma on this type of reaction to saving people, to killing bad guys, whatever the case may be, to not have that is not natural.
Right.
So I think it should become more commonplace. I think that...
Yeah, and the whole stigma thing, Scott, I was telling Scott the story of my sister's story, who, you know, had her... In 1996, her four-year-old and six-year-old sons were both murdered by their father, and then who then committed suicide. Nobody I know has seen their kids get killed other than my sister. You know, and so, you know, whenever you think it's bad, right, look around. There's normally somebody that you can find that's been through something worse. And the other thing I would tell the guys who listen to this and families that listen to this, we don't have a corner on post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
You know, right? Domestic violence victims, rape victims, people that have been victimized by violence and whatnot, they all go through it too. And we can help each other. And there's another concept called post-traumatic growth. There's a lot of people that go through this. And Scott's emblematic of it is using it as kind of a springboard to preach the gospel of overcoming, right? The gospel of compassion, the gospel of staying connected so that you can learn to live with it. You can learn to surf this, and your life, you know, doesn't have to be worse because of it. I saw a movie Elizabeth Smart made. I don't know if you've seen it. If you ever get a chance, I know this is incredibly feminine for Offering Radio, but it's the truth, because Gunner Mike Musselman, who's one of the toughest dudes I know, told me to watch it. Elizabeth Smart was abducted at the age of 14 and raped on a nightly basis for over 9 months until she escaped back in her hometown of Salt Lake City. She was hitchhiked and taken to San Diego County, and then she convinced her captor that God really wanted them to go back to Salt Lake City, and then while there, she got away. She has now married, she has two children, and she's fighting a fight for childhood trauma. That this doesn't have to be the period at the end of the sentence. That it's only a comma, and you'll write your own life. And it does. And I thought, and so when I watched it, I was like, she's awesome.
That's a survivor. Not
she's
a
awesome. No, and again, and we, you know, we all know people with tough experiences, and again, that's why I think the completeness of your book is in my opinion the coolest part of your book, because you know, again, I'm a military guy. I love reading military stuff, but I'm also the brother of a sister who suffered traumatic stress. I am the friend of a Gold Star family times two, and I presented the same woman, two different flags. And so there's all these other pieces to me that are rounded out by your book, and your book, you know, inspires that. It makes me think about that. And just even to drop them a note and say, hey, I was thinking of you today. You know, hope you're having a great day. And so I think that is the coolest part, at least in my opinion, my humble opinion, the coolest part of Echo and Ramadi is that it's fullness, right? It's not a narrow construct of simply the fighting in Ramadi. It is the experience, CONUS, and then forward and everything that goes in between. So,
yeah,
no, well done. What about the book Haven't I Been Smart Enough to Ask You that you want people to know?
I think that probably the last thing and most important to me is a portion of the proceeds of Echo and Ramadi go to my foundation, Save the Brave, to help veterans with post-traumatic stress. And that foundation was started by one of my young warfighters who I fought alongside in Ramadi, who really got it better than me when he said, we just need to get guys together and help. So, you know, there's a lot of people that don't know how to help veterans. People say they want to, or they say thank you for your service, but this is a way you can help. You buy a copy of Echo and Ramadi, go on Amazon today, click buy now, and you're helping veterans. It's that simple, because I donate a portion of the proceeds to Save the Brave, and you can find out more about Save the Brave if you go to savethebrave.org. It's a 100% nonprofit. None of us on the board take a single dime. Everything goes to veteran outreach programs, and not only helping veterans that are struggling with the effects of post-traumatic stress, but we also help out our Gold Star families that need us in some of the darkest places that they're in as well. So it's, again, I like to give first, and I think good things happen, you know, when you do that, if that's your philosophy. And it's not just a great story. You're getting an opportunity to help veterans as well.
You know, I tell a story about volunteering for Special Olympics, and I love to do that with our family. And you come home, and everybody has such a great day. And it's like, did we volunteer? Did we give more than we got? Because I feel like we got more out of this experience than we gave, and that's exactly what you're talking about. Is it seems like in life, the more you give of yourself, the more life tends to somehow or other give back, and the richer your life becomes. So, Scott, let me compliment you on not only the scope of your work and the tenor of your work, but also the nonprofit stuff. And it's all the stuff that we believe in. And I think all of us have been so deeply scarred by the courage and selflessness that we've seen, whether it be Generation X, Generation Y, Millennials, Generation Z, the baby boomers, or the greatest generation. So well done, bud. Well done. And thanks for coming on today and doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. It's my honor and my pleasure to be here in Costa Mesa in the studio. It's great.
First time ever. All right, tell everybody one more time. Where can they find the book?
You can find the book on Amazon. Just type in Echo and Ramadi or Scott Husing on Amazon. You can buy it at barnesandnoble.com. You can go to your local Costco or your local Barnes & Noble bookseller, and it's pretty much at bookstores everywhere. It's a bestseller on Amazon. And if you want to find out more about Save the Brave, go to savethebrave.org. And if you want to see some pictures about the Marines and some of the stories of the place we've been, you can get it on my website at echoandramadi.com. And there's a lot of photos, videos, and some of the people that are actually written about in this story.
There you have it. Echo and Ramadi, Major Scott Husing, United States Marine Corps retired. More coming up next right here on All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.